Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we will welcome two astronomers into the studio. Bob Berman is joined by Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory at MySci in Schenectady. Whether your question is about the sun, the planets, black holes, whatever, if you have an astronomy question, now's the time to call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us if you are the shy and retiring type. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email address. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, your astronomy questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hi again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today. Double the fun, double the information. We have one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world here. Bob Berman is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is the chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory, located in MySci in Schenectady, New York. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. Her dissertation focused on the chemical composition and structure of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. If you have a question for our astronomers today, the number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. Bob and Valerie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah, thank you, Ray.
Exciting things in the news about space. The one that caught my eye the other day, maybe it was even today, I don't know. Moss piglets, water bears. What are they and why are they on the moon?
Yeah, so there was this Israeli spacecraft that was headed towards the moon, and unfortunately it ended up crash landing on the moon. And on it, there was this quartz disc that had all sorts of cool stuff. It had, you know, like half the books that humans ever wrote etched in nickel on it. And it also had these little water bears, these microscopic creatures that are supposed to be really good at surviving in harsh environments, even on the moon.
Now, I understand that these water bears, these, what are they called, tardigrades?
Yeah, tardigrades.
They have been sent to space. I assume in orbit before, and they basically can be rehydrated at any time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what they did with these. They dehydrated them, sent them up to the moon, and maybe in the future, if we ever get back to the moon, we'll see if we can rehydrate them and bring them back to life.
When we were discussing this prior to the program, Bob brought up a point, and that is, in the old days, you weren't supposed to bring anything that is alive or could be alive to another body out in space.
Absolutely. That was verboten. In fact, even these days, we send spacecraft that look like they're going to no longer function, as we did with the recent Cassini mission. We send it screaming through the atmosphere so that it burns up and sterilizes anything rather than contaminate, possibly, another celestial body. But I guess somebody decided that the moon's okay. The moon, hey, let's contaminate the moon. That's that. The old rules don't apply anymore.
The space, the 50-year anniversary of the moon, the first moon landing this summer. And, you know, it occurs to me, just talking about this whole contamination issue, why did the astronauts have to spend X number of hours or days in decontamination if they were out in space?
No, because we didn't know for sure that there wasn't anything on the moon dust, that there wasn't some organism. I mean, just think about this. All it would have taken is a Martian organism thrown out into space by a meteor impact on Mars, and then eventually maybe that could have plotted into the moon. So you could have even had something from another part of the solar system. And now the astronauts have moon dust. They all had it. They even smelled it. They breathed it in. They all reported what it smells like, which was, by the way, unpleasant, they all said.
Interesting.
And so now they're back on Earth. You better believe we want to quarantine them for a few days before they come back and then the whole human race is wiped out a few weeks later.
Right, right. I mean, we're playing it safe. You know, until we know better, we might as well just play it safe.
Now, these, what are they called? Water bears, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. They survive in very cold temperatures, very hot temperatures.
Right.
No air virtually for long periods of time. What? How do we know these aren't on all the planets? I mean, something this hardy could be out there and we don't even know it.
Right. Well, I think that's the point, is that they could be out there. It seems like, you know, no matter where we look on Earth, as nasty as it would be for a human being to be there, these water bears are thriving. So it's completely possible that they are, you know, potentially on Mars, in the oceans, on Europa. They could be anywhere. We just have to look for them.
Astronomy today on the program, and we have Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson here to answer your questions. ALMA is in the news. What is ALMA, and why should I care?
I'll answer what is ALMA, and then Valerie can talk. You know what? Why doesn't she do the whole thing?
Okay.
I just realized. Because right, I just sure. came back from near ALMA. That's why it's in my mind.
ALMA is an acronym. What is ALMA?
Yeah, it's the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It's basically a collection of very large radio dishes in South America that are looking at the stars, looking at galaxies. And they were in the news recently because they took some new pictures of galaxies. Now, listeners might know about the Hubble Deep Field,
sure.
right? These pictures where we stared at one spot in the sky and we saw, you know, hundreds and hundreds of galaxies in one image. Well, ALMA took a look at the same region of sky and saw galaxies that were not in the Hubble Deep Field image.
Now, the deep field image that Hubble gives us, that's in the visual spectrum?
Exactly, right. Hubble primarily does visual astronomy, and ALMA is doing microwave astronomy. So it's looking at redder, longer wavelengths. And these galaxies, they are so distant that all of their light has been shifted to these redder wavelengths, so they wouldn't be visible to Hubble, but they would be visible to an infrared or a microwave telescope.
How many are we talking about here?
How many telescopes or how many galaxies?
How many galaxies did they find?
I think they only found a handful in the one image, but it suggests that, you know, when we make our estimates of the total number of galaxies in the universe, we are probably far underestimating what is actually there if we're only going by what Hubble shows us.
And incidentally, Hubble, that first deep field, looked beyond the stars of the Big Dipper, which is familiar to everybody, and stared at a spot only as large as a grain of sand held at arm's length. So that's a tiny piece of sky, but it stared at it for 100 hours. So it got as much light as it could gather and told us about, like, what's out there as far as it could look with their 94-inch mirror, far from the largest instrument on Earth, but the sharpest instrument. Subsequently, we've had deep fields in the southern hemisphere. The Big Dipper, of course, is northern, to kind of match that. And so this is exciting. So what's there beyond the visual that we didn't see that's visible in other parts of the spectrum? That's what this news is.
And what is the Spitzer scope?
Yeah, the Spitzer Space Telescope is an infrared space telescope. I believe they use that to start to get a sneak peek at these galaxies and realize that they might be even brighter at longer wavelengths.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here from the Dudley Observatory, and our old friend Bob Berman is here as well. I wonder if any of your books were on that crystal dumped on the moon by the Israelis.
Well, if I said half of the books written,
you've written a quarter of them, right?
I've written 12, so maybe six of them were up there. Right, one of them got me on the Letterman show.
Well, there you go. All right, let's go to the phones and grab a call or two before a first break. Mark in Salem. Mark, you're up.
Hi, Ray. this question is more directed towards Valerie. I worked at the Dudley Observatory when it was in Albany between 1970 and 1975. I was a student of astronomy and physics, and we had our mission at that time was, well, the radio telescope up Bolt Landing,
sure.
And the study of space dust. I was a sneeze away from moon dust for a couple of times, and then of course you moved to Schenectady.
Yep.
What is the if I can use the word mission statement,
sure.
of the Dudley now, besides the rare book collection.
Yeah, so our mission is really to do astronomy education for people of all ages. It's my job to come out here, get on the radio, teach classes, you know, basically share the science that's going on. We don't do as much research anymore.
So there's no active project as much as Except your own and that kind
right.
of thing.
Right. No serious research projects that we're working on right now, but we do have a beautiful telescope that the public can come look through, and we're more hoping to inspire children and adults to further look into astronomy.
Where is that in Schenectady?
It's right in downtown Schenectady at the Museum of Innovation and Science.
Can you see anything with the light pollution?
You know, you can actually see quite a bit because the telescope is 14 inches. It kind of pierces through that light pollution, and you can still see a whole lot right from downtown.
And Mark, when you were... Go ahead, Mark.
You can put filters on the eyepiece, too.
Sure, sure.
Hey, Mark, when you were working there, was that on Fuller Road?
Yes. A shared facility with the Atmospheric Science Research Center. Mm-hmm. Curtis Hemingway was the director.
Yeah.
And it was the BOSS General Catalog, which was about the positions of the stars, had been done much earlier. And now we were collecting space dust because we hadn't, at that point... We had landed on the moon, but up to that time, they were trying to figure out how deep is that stuff on the moon going to be. Mm. And they were trying to make estimates of it using every method that they could, including setting missiles up with sticky paper on them to collect dust from outer space.
Right.
So it was quite the active facility. I think our budget at that time was about $5 million a year.
Okay.
So we had it was a big operation.
All right, Mark, well, we got to take a break here, but thank you very much for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We have Bob Berman in the house. We have Valerie Rapson in the house. Your astronomy calls. More questions coming up. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today. Bob Berman is here and Dr. Valerie Rapson here from Dudley Observatory. Our last caller, Mark, was mentioning that he worked there in the 70s and they had a nice $5 million budget in the early 70s. Pretty sizable. And now, before they were at... You guys are in Schenectady now, downtown.
Right.
And then when he worked there, it was on Fuller Road in Albany, near Colony.
Mm-hmm.
And way back when, I've seen pictures of the original Dudley Observatory, and that was quite impressive.
Yes, yes, yes. It used to be, I believe the original one was around where Arbor Hill Elementary School is now in Albany.
Yeah. Our number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question about the heavens, and Marcia in Altamont is on. Marcia.
Hi there. I have a question about the Perseid meteor shower, which I understand will be peaking within the next few days.
Yeah.
And my question is kind of twofold. One is, could you explain a bit to us who are not so knowledgeable about what this is? And also, could you give us some tips on how to watch for it, what we might watch for, what the best times are, the direction to look in, and what we might be looking at when we see it?
Yes, this is good news, bad news year for the Perseids. Perseids are a wonderful shower, reliable, the remnants of a comet named Swift Tuttle. They're both interesting guys. Swift and Tuttle were Civil War astronomers. You know, these days you'd name who's a popular astronomer. You might think of Neil deGrasse Tyson or Carl Sagan. Back then, these were the guys. Horace Swift, and I forgot Tuttle's name, one with a mustache, one with a beard.
Nice.
And each of them co-discovered this comet. And it turns out that everything that we see in terms of Perseid meteors are pieces that have sloughed off this comet. And so it has the same orbit the comet does and comes in at a very high speed because the comet has a kind of retrograde motion. So it meets us head on. Earth goes 18 and a half miles a second as we orbit the sun, and the fragments from this comet go 18 and a half miles a second the other way, and so this is a head-on collision. So they smash into us at 37 miles a second. Wow, that's fast, and they look fast, and that's great. So what's not to like? Unfortunately, to see a meteor shower, most meteors are medium to faint. Some of them are medium bright. Only a relatively few of the 60 per hour that you can expect are bright. And all those dim and medium dim ones will be washed out if the sky is bright. So if you try to watch from a city,
right.
big city like downtown Albany, you're going to miss most. And if the moon is bright, you're going to miss most. Mm-hmm. And this year, the moon is bright. The moon is going to be full on Wednesday night, and the shower is at its right. best on Sunday night, Sunday okay. night and Monday. On top of that, the shower is at its best after midnight.
Okay.
That's when the radiant, that is the spot in the sky, Perseus, that the meteors seem to stream from. It's always best to have the radiant in the sky because before midnight, you're only going to see the ones that are rising up from the radiant. Once you have the radiant up, you'll see those that are going sideways from
right.
it and downward from it. So you see a lot more meteors. So long-winded way of saying you want to be observing after midnight or 1 a.m. to see the greatest number by far. And you want no moon. There's nothing we can do other than destroying the moon between now and
right.
then.
Right, and we don't want to do that.
We're not going to do that. So kind of have reduced expectations this year. Go out, be patient, keep watching up. The big mistake that people make is they talk to their friends that they're with, and they only glance up now and then.
Right.
And you're going to miss them because they're so fast. So you keep your eyes glued to the sky. And this year you'll see instead of the 60 an hour, you might see 12 an hour, which means one every few minutes.
But they'll be good ones.
Yeah, yeah. So keep watching and you will see them.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Every now and again, you get the big fireball. What's the longest transit that someone could possibly see a fireball in the sky?
Oh, I've certainly seen. We just saw one in South America a couple of weeks ago that must have lasted a full 10 seconds.
Wow.
Which is very long.
That's long.
And let's understand that when we're seeing them, we're not actually seeing the meteoroids themselves, which are typically smaller than a raisin, but we're seeing the glowing sphere of ionized air around them that's been superheated by this high speed through the atmosphere. So you've got about a foot in diameter ball of glowing air, and that's what you're seeing. Typically, they'll be 80 miles away.
Okay.
And they'll move 200,000 of their own diameters per second. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes for speed, because we humans perceive speed when we see something shift its own diameter per second. An example would be a mouse, I understand, can scamper at 9 miles an hour, which is the same speed that a horse walks during a fast walk. Same speed, horse, mouse.
Right.
But the horse at that speed doesn't look like he's moving really
right.
fast, but the mouse seems supersonic because the mouse is traversing 24 mouse lengths per second,
yeah.
and so it seems like a bullet. So same thing with the meteors. These are we're seeing the gas ball move 200,000 gas ball widths per second. Although it's 80 miles away, it still looks darn fast.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here. Bernard is in Rosendale. Bernard, you're on.
Hi. My question is more a matter of cosmology, I think. But has anyone considered ordinary gravity creating the dark energy situation by way of 12 universes around ours, outside of our view? In other words, why not, you know, beyond every horizon in the history of humanity, there's always been something.
So, in other words, you said 12 universes?
Nothing on the other side of what we see, to me, is you know, not the first thing I would think of. And the way you would find that out would be if there's an asymmetry in terms of the materials moving away from, you know, accelerating away from us in a way that it seemed anomalous when there was only one universe to consider.
Right. Well, I definitely know that there are people looking into this multiverse theory, right? Whether there are
but
other universes.
Isn't that multiverse theory mostly a matter of universes right within the same space, but by different dimensions
well,
that they're talking about?
That then depends on how you define universe, right? You know, universe is everything we could possibly conceive of. So it's hard to say, you know, what's in and outside our universe. But they have worked on, you know, various universes and how they might pull. And, you know, gravity is such a weak force that, you know, even at those larger scales when we do see it interacting what appears to be more strongly, you know, I don't know if another universe could do it. And to my understanding, we've looked in all directions and all the galaxies seem to be moving away from us for the most part at, you know, the speeds we would expect based on their distance. So I haven't heard anything about any fluctuations.
Now, when you say for the most part, what are the exceptions?
Well, there's a couple galaxies that are nearby, like the Andromeda Galaxy, for example, that's actually close enough to the Milky Way to be pulled by the Milky Way's gravity, and they are actually on a head-on collision course. About 3 billion years from now, we'll be colliding directly with that galaxy.
And the Milky Way is the bigger of the two?
No, the Milky Way is the smaller of the two.
So we will be subsumed by the big...
Most likely, yeah. Most likely we are going to be in big trouble.
Okay, we'll probably not be
right. Is the community still believing that there is an acceleration away from the center of the so-called, you know, the Big Bang, so to
yes.
speak? Which is accounted for by something that no one's ever found called dark energy.
Right, yes, that
my
is...
My way of thinking, that's not the first thing you would think of. The first thing you would think of would be gravity of another from another place. And to my way of thinking, why wouldn't there be 12 universes around ours pulling outwardly, you know, similar universes that had their big bangs and are going to have a big crunch, you know, in some point in the future. I don't understand. Why hasn't that been thought of?
Okay, I'll tell you what.
I'm asking.
My turn.
To explain dark energy.
All right, Bob.
Okay. Because what we see in the acceleration away from us is very even and very smooth, what's called
the
Hubble
thing.
Constant.
Is it very even, or are there asymmetries that haven't been really ascertained yet? Because
all right, well, let
me answer you.
Yeah.
No. There are no real asymmetries. What we see is as we look into space, every million light years farther, things are rushing away 14 miles per second faster. Usually astronomers use kilometers per second per megaparsec, but I'm giving it to you in the units that all of us use. Every million light years, 14 miles per second faster. And that is so... Yes,
right.
And that is so smooth and so even in all directions, and there's no asymmetries at all.
Right.
Whereas if somebody's proposing that it's actually gravity pulling from other directions, what you'd get is, number one, all these 12, as you say, other universes would be pulling in different directions, so there'd be unevennesses and asymmetries. There would have to be in the different directions. Plus, gravity, as you know, falls off inversely with the square of distance, so we'd be seeing a differential gravitational pull from these other objects depending upon how far we were away from them. That's not what we observe. So you can take...
So it has been looked for, because I hadn't seen anything about... I know that it's relatively symmetrical, but I didn't know if it had been searched for in a minute, you know, in a minuteness like that, because it could be that the asymmetries are very, 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 very slight, if there was such a, you know, a case. Anyway, that's a very good answer for my question. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bernard. We appreciate the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. Of course, gravity is still something of a mystery, though, right? There could be aspects of gravity that we don't quite get.
It's the most mysterious of the four fundamental forces. It's fundamentally the most mysterious.
And why haven't we gotten a handle on it?
One of the reasons is the inability to formulate a theory of quantum gravity. Everything else seems to be quantized. Ever since quantum theory came into existence, things we find that works with everything else.
Yeah, all right, explain for those listening. You said everything else seems to be quantized. What does that mean?
For example, on the small scale, electrons orbiting a nucleus can't just be in any position. They can only be here. Or there, and no place in between. So those are specific units, and that's what we call quanta. Interestingly enough, when an electron, listen to this, this is going to blow your mind.
All right.
When an electron jumps from one of these permitted orbitals to another, it does not pass through the space in between them. It simply disappears from being in one, and then is suddenly at another. And then there is a release of energy if it's moving inward towards the center of its atom. So these are quanta. Now, we would love to see gravity working like that, but we don't. The truth is, you could take Earth, and if you could shove it 1 million miles sunward of where it is, it would orbit very happily in that new position, albeit a little faster and with a shorter year than we currently have. So we don't see this. However, there's reason to believe that nonetheless it can be quantized. But to do that, to do a theory that makes gravity quantized, is essentially finding a way to link quantum theory with general relativity. General relativity rules gravity. So here you're uniting them. And the problem is, as soon as you start to unite them, the math that worked at one scale does not work at the other scale. It becomes uncontrollable. It doesn't work. You're back to square one. So this has been even Einstein worked on this the final years of his life. This would be the grandest unified theory. This would be the theory of everything if you could find a way to make general relativity and quantum theory somehow work together in a new way. And quantum gravity is at the heart of that search. And the fact that we don't have that answers the question, whatever it was. I forgot what the question was.
Well, what are we missing? Do we have a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of matter, or do we have a fundamental misunderstanding of space itself? Why the problem here?
I don't really know. So, like, in most cases, when you develop these more advanced mathematics, basically Einstein's relativity, you can simplify relativity by plugging in the numbers that work on the average human scale, not on the astronomical scale. And relativity breaks down to Newton's laws of gravity, Kepler's laws of gravity. We haven't found a way to take relativity or even some higher level mathematics and keep plugging in those smaller and smaller numbers, smaller and smaller scales, to break them down to get what the quantum world shows us. So whether it's a misunderstanding of how things work or just a level of math we haven't gotten to yet, I'm not really sure where it's going to go.
But it's failed up till down. In other words, the physics of the large,
right?
We've not found a way to make it talk to the physics of the small.
Exactly.
And we have these two great pillars that are very successful for now a century of quantum theory for the small, general relativity for the large, and we can't get them to work together or talk together.
And they can coexist? You're okay with this?
Well, as long as you're looking at the small, sure, quantum theory works fine.
The stuff that's in between?
Well, there's...
That's us. I mean, we're in between, so...
Yeah, there's us. Quantum theory, we use classical science, classical physics for us. This is still macroscopic enough that we're not in the quantum realm.
Yeah.
In the quantum realm, I mean, you've heard about this. Things can be in two places at once. And things don't exist until you observe them. And things can be waves and particles. And until you look at them, they're not either. But in real life around here, and a cat could be alive and dead at the same time.
Now, you just said in real life.
But in real life.
Is quantum just a magic trick?
No. Because the point is, in real life, the moon is in one place. And if a football is kicked, it either clears the crossbar or it doesn't, but it doesn't do both. And a cat is either alive or dead or can't be in a superposed position of being both. So there's different rules between classical physics and the quantum world, and you better believe that people are trying to find a way and have been for decades. And if they can, that's where this all came from, quantum gravity. That's where quantum gravity would be the first big thing solved if it ever could be done.
Our number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. 800-348-2551. Another article that crossed, this was in Science and Astronomy a couple of days ago by Elizabeth Howell. Hubble captures spiral galaxy with barrier of dust. And there's a photo of spiral galaxy NGC 3169. And apparently this is a big deal. It's showing stuff sort of lurking.
Right.
I guess I don't understand why this is a big deal.
Right. Well, it's a big deal because of the way the galaxy looks. The galaxy, from our perspective, happens to be tipped at just the right angle so that we're not looking, you know, directly through the edge of the galaxy, but kind of tipped so that we can see the edge and the center. Mm. And there's this big dust ring around the edge. It's a nice spiral-armed galaxy with stars and gas and dust. And all of that material seems to be made of familiar things, hydrocarbon, water, stuff that we see in our own solar system.
And isn't this what you did your dissertation on?
Yeah, I focused mostly on the material that's around stars and our own galaxy, but it can be scaled up with galaxies as well. And the more we look, the more we see similar things everywhere in the universe.
And so what then can you deduce from that fact?
Well, if this galaxy is forming stars, which I'm sure it is, it's likely forming planets, and those planets are then going to potentially look similar to those in our solar system. There might be Earth-like planets, potential for life. You know, we can extend on and on.
You know, a little inside baseball. Bob is so bored with the planetary discoveries now. He's had enough. Yeah. You know, well, I get very excited. Oh, we found another
right.
planet.
No, it's enough. It's enough.
Really?
I mean, once you find the first trout in Lake Huron, whoever found the first trout, that was an exciting discovery.
Yeah, but trout are still tasty.
The 10,000th trout, if you want to specifically tag it and name it, is somewhat less exciting. Now, I get the thing. You know, until recently, there was one Earth, there was one Sun. There are things that there are one of. Mm-hmm. And in life, when there's one of, the idea that there might be another is very exciting. We have one heart. What if some doctor found that there's actually a second heart in each of us that wasn't previously recognized because it's buried in some other organ? We'd go, whoa! So, yes, of course, we want to look for another Earth, because then you can get imaginative. Or do we have analogs of ourselves there? Are there all the same silly things that we do in there? Or are they opposite us? You know, there's been a lot of science fiction about it. So when we found the first planets around a star named 52 Pegasi in the constellation of Pegasus, this is back in the 1990s, that was a big deal, even though Van de Kamp and others, when I was a kid, showed reason wobbles that some stars had that indicated there probably were other planets. But this was the first sure one.
Yeah.
That was exciting, Ray.
Okay.
And then once we started finding, hey, wait a minute, there's more of them. But at first we could only identify Jupiter-sized massive planets because those are the only ones that were going to make stars wobble at all.
You know,
but now, once we had the ability to find smaller things, mostly around very low-mass spectroclass M dwarf stars that are so lightweight that they'll wobble, anything will make them wobble. So even Earths going around them make them wobble. Now we know there's other Earths. That was exciting, too.
You know, you're cynical.
But what about your 911th Earth?
All right. Well, let's take a break, and we'll discuss that on the way back here. Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Valerie, for being here. It's Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. Berman is cynical, but we'll try to bring him back to that sense of wonder after the break. You know, there's no talking to Bob Berman about some things. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today. Bob Berman is here. And then on the excited and somewhat sensible side of astronomy, there's Dr. Valerie Rapson, who wants to rebut all we just heard from Bob Berman.
Bob, I got to respectfully disagree with you. You know, I'm so excited about all these exoplanet discoveries that I have an app on my phone that sends me push notifications every time we get a new one. And sometimes it's 5 times a day, and I get excited every single time the phone beeps.
Why do you get excited?
Well, because to me, every planet is different. You know, you're right. You know, all the trouts are kind of the same, but some are bigger, some are smaller. The colors are a little different. You know, we never know what we're going to find. And all of these new planets, they're all so different and unique in their own way.
And we won't find out how really unique they are or what life is on them until we go there. And that's 5,000 years.
So let's go.
That's okay.
I mean, come on. That's progress, right? Let's go.
5,000 years
for
the trip?
Hey, you know, they said you couldn't cross the ocean. They crossed the ocean. They said you couldn't go to the moon.
Got
they
a went dream, to the moon. Right?
Exactly. We will do these things not because they are easy and the other things, but because they were hard, right? Let's go.
Where have I heard that?
I don't know. Number's 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today on the program. By the way, before we get to the next call, Valerie, you got some sci-fi doings.
We do, yes. For those in the area, this Saturday, we're doing sci-fi at MySci, so you can come visit us. You can make slime with the Ghostbusters.
Oh, cool.
Take a picture next to the DeLorean. Go inside of a TARDIS.
There's going
to
be a DeLorean
there?
There's
going to be a DeLorean there.
Stainless
okay?
steel car?
Yes, like legit DeLorean.
Can
You've
I drive it?
See it. I don't know about that, but you can definitely take a selfie with it.
I want to drive it, Valerie. Come on. You're going to be on my show?
Hey, that's out of my control,
All
man.
Right. This email came in, and then we'll jump back on the phones. This one is from Jonathan in East Chatham. If the universe is expanding, where is it expanding from, and is anything being created with this expansion? And that's from Jonathan.
Oh, that's a tough one, because the answer is really hard to explain, but the short answer is it's expanding from everywhere. There is no center of the universe. I can't look in the sky and point to a certain spot. The universe is expanding at all points, kind of like, you know, baking of the raisin bread. The raisins are the galaxies. They're all moving away and the dough is expanding. And no, nothing new is being created. The space is just growing larger. It's stretching like a rubber band.
Well, that was the big difference between Fred Whipple, but going back into the early 50s, and the Big Bang. And Fred Whipple, who created the term, Fred Hoyle, I'm sorry. Whipple was a comet expert. We actually did a cruise with him. We did a comet cruise.
Oh, yeah? Is he still around?
He's pretty old. If he's still around, he's even older. He was in his 90s when I was doing when I was the other astronomer with him doing a cruise. That was Hal Bopp, so we're going back to the 90s.
Okay, so he would be in his hundreds now. So.
So forget that.
All right.
In any case, Hoyle said that, yes, new things are being created, and as the universe is expanding, little atoms are popping into space. And he showed that if one hydrogen atom popped into the space the size of a football stadium once per century, that could make up for the disappearing matter of the expanding universe, would replenish it, and what we'd end up with is a universe that always looked the same. And he called that the steady state. And back in the 1950s, any textbook would have told you there are two ideas. They're each could be true. We don't know yet. Steady state and the Big Bang. None is more logical than the other, because with the Big Bang, you also have matter popping out of nothing, except it all happened at once.
Mm-hmm.
Boom! The whole universe popped out at one time. The other way, it kind of just leaks in like a dripping faucet. So who's to say which is more logical than the other? Either way, stuff appeared seemingly out of nothing, and then the universe is expanding.
So what was the mechanism that made things appear out of nothing?
What's the mechanism from the Big Bang? No one has an idea. No one has a clue.
Nope.
That's it? Show's over. Oh, no, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Paul in Albany. Paul, you're on.
Hi. I had some experience with the Dudley Observatory when I was a kid. We actually went there as a class in elementary school.
Awesome.
And I think it was actually located in what was then a park west of Albany Medical Center. It's now Capital District Psychiatric Center.
Yep, you got it.
I think it was actually Dudley Observatory and Planetarium was, I think, the official name at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely used to be out there, and we were letting the public observe towards the end there. I think we were in that location until about the 1970s, if I remember correctly, mid to late
70s. What happened?
Whenever the state took it to build the psychiatric center.
Yeah, the state took over the land, unfortunately, and then ultimately that building burned down, so neither of the two original observatories are standing anymore.
You mentioned one I never heard of where the Arbor Hill Elementary School was located.
Yeah, that was our original one from the 1850s up until about 1893 or so.
Okay, that predates me.
Yeah, me too.
All right, well, thanks a lot for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here, and Dr. Valerie Rapson, and Judy is in Pittsfield. Judy, you're on.
Hi. Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. One of the many things that I can't wrap my head around, including string theory and multiverse, is how we're able to gauge far distant stars and gauge their density, their size, or anything, when all we're seeing are the few photons that are shooting off of the curved surface of this semisphere. And extrapolated out over billions of light years, those little photons have got to be millions of miles away or apart. I'm sorry, miles apart. How are we able to discern anything about these far distant stars?
If you were watching, Judy, Bob Berman just shot his hand up like it was a classroom. All right, Bob, we're calling on you.
Because in the middle of the 19th century, there was a French astronomer. I think it was Camille Flammarion, but it might have been another famous French astronomer who said, realizing, as you have, Judy, how far away the stars are. And he said, of only one thing I can be certain, we will never know what the stars are made of. And within 10 years, spectroscopy changed that. And that was in 1859 when Robert Bunsen and his companion started to realize from a burning building a mile away that this newfangled multi-prism thing, they could look through it, and they saw the chemical signature of elements that they'd previously heated up in their lab, and they could tell what was in the fire, the lead from pipes and stuff. They could say there's lead there just from the light from this burning fire a mile away. And they realized that, wait a minute, this means that if we looked at the stars, we'd know what they're made of. It was like the most amazing thing. And since then, 75% of professional astronomers' time is on spectroscopy. Astronomers don't look at the little dots of light because that won't tell you anything. Instead, the light is broken up into its wavelengths, all those pretty colors, and then there are these black lines called Fraunhofer lines that will tell you, give you the signature of all the elements. So that's the main thing. And then from there, what if you have two sets of lines and they change position? That tells you that it's really a double star that you could never have told looking at it because the two companions are too close together, that are going around each other so that one has a blue shift while the other has a red shift where the lines are going in opposite directions right before our eyes. And then you can tell the period because of how long it takes them to do that, and therefore their masses and how far apart they are and what they're made of. And that tells you what temperature they must be in order to be made of what they're made of. Like we looked at Vega, the star Vega, through a spectroscope just this past week in my observatory. It only shows the lines of hydrogen because it's so darn hot on the surface. You look at Betelgeuse and you get all these bands of cooler stuff, not cool in the hip sense, cool right. being temperature, even titanium oxide, even molecules can exist there. So the answer, Judy, is spectroscopy.
So you can use that on one stream of photons, which are minuscule, and might be the only ones hitting us at that given moment. You can tell all of that
yes.
by one stream of photons?
Yes. Yeah.
Let me give you an analogy, Judy. Our sun, which is not all that powerful of a star, but the luminosity, the amount of photons that our sun emits in 1 second is enough to power the current human energy demands for 500,000 years. That's
yes,
how much light the sun is putting out. So if you look at other stars, you know, they're far, but they're still emitting plenty of light.
Oh, yeah.
But if we're 200 billion light years away from our star or any star, those photons being coming from a curved surface,
mm-hmm.
you know, a billionth of a degree apart,
yep.
extrapolated out, those photons are going to be millions of miles apart. Now, we're lucky enough to catch just one stream.
Yeah, we can get enough to do it. Believe it or not, our technology is good enough to do it.
And you trust the technology that much?
I do. I wrote my thesis thanks to that technology, so I have to trust it.
All right, Judy, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. And before we get to the next call, Bob, I know I forgot to mention this earlier. You have an event coming up yourself.
Yeah, I'm going to be speaking at the Poughkeepsie Library tomorrow evening. At what time? I forgot what time. It's in my appointment book.
Oh, really?
But I understand that people have to sign up ahead of time, so you'd have to go to poklib.org.
Yep.
And just look at events and sign up and come.
So it's tomorrow.
Tomorrow night.
And what will you be talking about?
Be talking about the cataclysms in the universe.
Oh, the book.
This is
great.
It's based on the book.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. And I can't wait for that movie. That's going to be exciting. Like one of those Irwin Allen films. Remember the big disaster films?
Thank you. From your mouth to God's ears.
That's all right. I'll be your agent. Bob Berman is our guest today. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here from the Dudley Observatory in My Science Schenectady. So you said you have a 17-inch telescope?
14-inch.
14-inch telescope.
Yep.
What are the most exciting things you look at regularly when you bring kids in
Personally, I love the nebulas and the galaxies, although the kids sometimes find it difficult to see because you have to use your peripheral vision, you know, look out of the corners of your eye to see these things. But I really enjoy those more deep sky objects. The kids really enjoy Saturn and Jupiter. You know, they want to see the planets because they can relate to that and they've seen pictures, and to see it in real life, you know, you'd be shocked at the number of kids that look at me and go, no way, you put a sticker on the telescope, it's not real. And I'm like, no, that's actually Saturn. You can see the rings.
I kid you not. Now, I know that you've had a sense of wonder about the heavens since you were a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you do what you do. Since I've been about five, I've wanted to see Saturn through a telescope.
Yeah.
I had a telescope for a while. Couldn't make it. I could barely find the moon.
I mean,
it was not
some of those small ones are tough.
Well, it was a big one.
Oh.
Yeah, and very inept. Let's go back to the phones. Vincent and Troy. Vincent, you're on.
Yes. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. You know, my question was, how did the Dogon people know so much about the star Sirius and the dog star that accompanied in its orbit and everything without all this advanced technology?
That's a good question. So the ancients knew a lot about the stars.
That was the mystery. There was a book called The Sirius Mystery, S-I-R-I-U-S, based on the brightest star in the sky. And boy, it created a big brouhaha about 30 years ago. The idea was that a tribe that was just recently discovered in East Africa, the Dogon, knew not only they worshiped Sirius, as many cultures did. It's the brightest star in the sky. But here's the thing. They knew that it has a companion, which can only be seen through a pretty darn good telescope. And they knew about the 50-year period in which the companion, the dwarf star, sometimes called the pup, goes around Sirius. How could they know that since they'd never been visited before and never and certainly didn't have a telescope or knew anything about it? And the book's author concluded that they were visited by creatures from the Sirius star system sometime in the ancient past who told them all about that.
It's a bit of a leap, but we'll see. All right.
Well, those of us who more trust Occam's razor, which is the simplest explanation is usually the correct one, would say, well, how about this instead of that? How about if they were visited earlier than we think they were by other missionaries who often had portable telescopes, by the way, with them in Victorian times, and then seeing that they worship the star, told them the news, because after all, we've known about the companion to Sirius since, I think, about 1890, and told them about it, which they then incorporated into their rituals. And now here we are seemingly discovering them some decades later. They know all about Sirius, and that would be the answer that I'd vote for.
Can I say something, though? But they told Westerners about this long before Westerners even knew about the companion star, and they also told them it was, you know, I remember they say that thimble full of the material from the dwarf star is, you know, is the heaviest material on the earth. They knew a lot about
since about 1890. So I've read some scholarly pieces about that said that when they were visited the second time, that was after we the earth and astronomers already had this knowledge about white dwarf. White dwarfs were the first amazing star. That was the second one found after 40 Omicron Eridani. Omicron Eridani 2. That's the easiest white dwarf star. Boy, it took me a moment. That's easy in any telescope. But this one is right after that, the Sirius, because these are all pretty close by. And interestingly enough, this is what I find amazing. The other dog star, Procyon, is in the constellation of the Little Dog.
Yeah.
That has a white dwarf companion, a crushed star also. So here we've got Sirius at 8.65 light years. Here we've got Procyon only a little further. So they're all over the place. They're actually pretty common.
All right. Well, I think that's where we will have to leave it. Valerie Rapson, how do people find out more about the Dudley Observatory?
Well, they head to dudleyobservatory.org or mysci.org and check us out.
Okay. And the big sci-fi event is?
Yes, Sci-Fi at My Sci this Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
And you're going to get the keys to the DeLorean for me?
I'll try. I'll do the best. I'll give you a call. I can.
Bob Berman, the event at the Poughkeepsie Library, how do people find out more?
By going to, I wrote it down, Poke Lib. POKLIB.org, then looking under events and just sign up.
All right. Well,
it's free, though.
Thank you both for being here. Support comes from Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, practicing aesthetic medicine and cosmetic plastic surgery, working to help people build their confidence and well-being with a woman's touch, CAPEKplasticsurgery.com. And Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials, Rhinebeck New Paltz, and at 793 Broadway in Kingston, rhinebeckart.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. As always, very interesting questions today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who's always very interesting when he runs the controls for this program. Amber Sickles took the calls. Jim Lavoulis is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, the three minds behind a new vegan cookbook join the program with their recipes in hand. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.